Welcome to Living Well into the Future. I'm your host, Julie Beandler. Today, we continue our series on resilience as we look to problem solvers to find ways for our communities and ourselves to thrive in the face of decisions made in the past and uncertainties in the future. In our last episode, we spoke with Milltown Capital and their collaborators about impact investing, traditional investing, and philanthropy as a way to develop community-wide resilience in the rural Berkshires. Today, we will continue to focus on resilience at the community level, but in an urban landscape. In addition to speaking with Dr. Tony Arnold, a founder of the Resilience Justice Project, we will hear cross-generational perspectives from two Resilience Justice Fellows working with him both on scholarly work and at a practical level with community groups, nonprofits, and governmental entities at the local, state, and national level. Through them, we will get another perspective on what resilience means for communities. We'll learn the conditions that negatively impact residents' health and well-being, that we, both outsiders and the residents themselves, take for granted, but could be improved through resilience justice analysis and methods. You can hear this and previous episodes of Living Well into the Future on WTBR-FM, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and other streaming services. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and give us a 5-star rating so others can find us. For more information about our guests, show notes, and about past episodes, go to our website, livingwellintothefuture.net. Our guest, Craig Anthony Arnold, known as Tony, is an internationally renowned transdisciplinary scholar. His work encompasses the areas of land, water, the environment, governmental systems, resilience, and social and environmental justice. He's also an award-winning teacher and mentor. Since 2005, Dr. Tony Arnold has been the Bowl Chair of Property and Land Use at the University of Louisville, where he directs the Resilience Justice Project and teaches in both the Brandeis School of Law and the Sustainability Urban Planning and PhD programs in the Department of Urban and Public Affairs. He is the author of many acclaimed and often cited books and articles. We will also speak to two of his students, Irene Ewers and Carcel Barrett, who are Resilience Justice Fellows for the Resilience Justice Project. Tony, great to speak with you. We haven't spoken in quite a while. How did you come to start the Resilience Justice Project?
In terms of the origins, I've had two streams that came together. I wrote the first study and then followed by a book on the relationship between environmental justice and land planning and land use regulation. And so that was one stream. Early in my career, my research went down the environmental justice road pathway of research, which all had to do with resilience, adaptive governance, and law, and looking at how governance systems and legal regimes need to change in order to help build social ecological resilience. But my piece of that ended up becoming a much more justice-focused piece, looking at how a lot of times low-income communities of color are less resilient, more vulnerable, and that when we talk about resilience, we have to be asking what kind of resilience, of what kind of system, under what kind of circumstances, but mostly who is benefited and not benefited by that. And so those sort of streams started merging together. And then in fall of 2016, I had a wonderful opportunity to go work with the Environmental Justice and Civil Rights and Urban Planning Organization in Los Angeles called the City Project, with a grant and be a visiting scholar at UCLA. And that was really where everything coalesced around this concept of resilience justice. And so it was very much related to community engaged work in Los Angeles in partnership with community organizations. And like I said, working with at UCLA and the Resilience Justice Projects launched from there, and many of those publications, which involve articles and book chapters and so on and so forth.
Let's start with your time in California and the articles that you published in the Seton Hall Law Review in 2022 that spoke about urban water rights. Our listeners are familiar with water issues. Do you remember Char Miller?
Yes. Yeah.
We spoke with Char in the last two episodes in which we discussed water rights. Char mentioned the tension between agricultural needs and the needs of the cities and other smaller communities. He also illustrated how political decisions can benefit or disadvantage one community above another, which relates to your work. So can you tell us more about that Seton Hall paper and the work behind it and how it relates to resilience?
This was early in the stages of developing a resilience justice assessment framework for looking at plans, policies, and laws through a resilience justice lens. And we identified some of the water issues in Fresno as an area for study, just as a sort of a test of our framework. And then we got connected with the City of Sacramento sustainability officer who was concerned about the water plan for the City of Sacramento. So we did this assessment of both cities, and they're both in the Central Valley where there are enormous water injustices in agricultural communities, primarily low-income, Latino, immigrant-based communities. And so you get a lot of attention and not enough action, but we do see a variety of environmental justice studies that deal with those agricultural areas. But you know, what we wanted to ask was, here we have urban water planning in California in a state that has a human right to water that's legally recognized, that has environmental justice requirements in the state laws, has very extensive urban water planning statute that requires local governments to do a variety of things with respect to urban water plans. And what we wanted to find out is, does all that law actually make a difference? Does it make it equitable, or are the laws inadequate? And does the planning fall short? And of course, we found that the planning falls short and the laws are inadequate, that there are a lot of things, say, for example, considering climate change. That both of those cities do a superficial job of considering climate change, but they're not actually applying multiple climate models, which is something that, say, for example, the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority does, but that sort of best practice is not really being followed in Sacramento or Fresno. And they're not considering climate inequities or vulnerabilities in the different neighborhoods and different communities, even though the neighborhood residents have more reliable and cleaner water than once you get outside the city into the rural areas, they still have inequitably polluted water and are more vulnerable to shocks to the system and to unaffordable water supplies that basically the plan built in price increases when there's scarcity, and the sort of the subsidies for the lowest income households does not go up proportionately during those timeframes. Yeah, so I did teams of resilience justice fellows over 2 years work with me on doing that research and publishing it. We shared our result with Sacramento because we had a collaboration. However, all that was after the entered the COVID pandemic state. So one of our challenges with communicating our research results and following up and continuing to be engaged is that the COVID pandemic was just a point of disconnection for a lot of things. So that's one of the reasons why we've built in a more sort of upfront plan for continued involvement in Southwest Louisville in the Mill Creek watershed and some follow-up work with the coastal urban areas that we're working with. So that's our hope to try to be more adaptive to disruptions like pandemics.
We'll find out about the Resilience Justice Project's work in Southwest Louisville and with the urban coastal areas in a few minutes. But you've just hit upon the subject of our current series, and that is resilience. Would you please define resilience as it applies to your work?
When we think about resilience, lots of different meanings that resilience can have. It's become a little bit of a buzzword. Resilience is about the idea that the world is constantly changing, is constantly disruptive, and having adaptive capacity is essential. But when people use the term resilience, it can mean a lot of different things. And of course, one thing that's really important has to do with individual human beings' resilience, the sort of mental health and being and physical health and being and so forth. And so that's obviously a key concept. When my colleagues in social work or psychology or the health sciences are dealing with resilience, they're often talking about the individual or the family unit or that sort of thing. Then there's a whole other sort of focus of resilience that deals with sort of social ecological systems, like our environments, how resilient is, say, for example, the Colorado River system, probably not very at the moment, or large scale, how resilient is our economy, how resilient is a city, how resilient is New York City or San Antonio or someplace like that. And so those are interesting. What we're concerned about is communities, is more in between the two scales. So collective groups of people, like in neighborhoods or in areas of where they live, where they're because of the combination of environmental systems, social, economic, and political systems, and institutions, governance institutions, that those communities are more vulnerable. And we can often refer to them as marginalized or maybe even oppressed, but these are communities that are more vulnerable. And so what we're looking at is a set of circumstances where the answer is not just improve your mental health. That is not a very effective answer if you are constantly surrounded by pollution and you're in a food desert and your community doesn't have affordable, healthy food options. If your neighborhood doesn't have green and blue infrastructure, parks and trees, or very little in the way of parks and trees, heat, you have heat island effects, you have flooding, you have these sorts of issues. And then the job opportunities are limited, the educational opportunities are limited. And then when there's some investment, maybe a new park system comes in, maybe a stream is restored, and now all of a sudden there's gentrification and displacement, and you can no longer afford to live there because it's now being redeveloped, and the community fabric and the community culture is changed, and what was there has been displaced by a community that has become wealthier and often less racially or ethnically diverse.
Now that you set the stage with what resilience is and what conditions require resilience and would require less resilience if they were ameliorated, let's talk about the real world projects the Resilience Justice Project is and has been involved in. You have a practice component with your service on and with various boards and governmental bodies, and have even worked with the city of Louisville to pass an anti-displacement ordinance.
Yeah, so I guess I've always thought that the divide between academia and what happens in the legal profession, government, public policy, the community, that's a really pretty artificial line. And yeah, so I've always been involved in different ways in community groups and collaborations and government boards and so forth. With the students in my teaching, I try to do a lot of very practical, real world engaged teaching. And of course, with the Resilience Justice Fellows, that's of course what they're doing in the work that we do.
We're going to speak with two of the current Resilient Justice Fellows, Ira Ewers and Carcel Barrett, later in this episode. Tony, you've received a grant to work with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Can you tell us about that and your other current project?
We have three major projects that are occurring right now as of summer 2024. First of all, we've got the Equitable Adaptation Project, which is a NOAA-funded project in partnership with research centers at Georgetown University and Georgia State University. And we're assessing how equitable climate adaptation planning is in eight major coastal urban areas. And there are Boston, Savannah, Miami, Tampa, New Orleans, San Diego, Seattle, and Cleveland. So the idea was to look at a diversity of different coastal urban areas and using the Resilience Justice Assessment Framework and then two other assessment frameworks, one that comes out of Georgetown's work on equitable adaptation and another one that comes out of Georgia State's work on resilient cities. And so we're doing this analysis, and the idea is to identify best practices, to identify weaknesses and gaps, and to make recommendations both to government agencies and community groups in those eight urban areas, but also to create a set of tools that can be used nationally and perhaps even internationally to help coastal urban areas be more equitable and focus on the vulnerability of marginalized communities, particularly low-income neighborhoods of color. So that's one project. Then we are continuing our work in Southwest Louisville. The communities and neighborhoods are located within the Mill Creek watershed, which is in Southwest Louisville. And this is an area that is an environmental justice frontline community. They have two major industrial areas that are located right among the neighborhoods. There are two major power plants. The only two power plants in the Louisville area are both within the Mill Creek watershed, a notorious Superfund landfill site, and a lot of various environmental challenges, but also socioeconomic challenges. This is an area where a number of the neighborhoods are predominantly residents of color and or lower income, but some mixed area. And there's some neighborhoods that have higher income levels and that are more white residents and so forth. But overall, this is an area that is very much below median in as far as Louisville goes and has been historically ignored. And so we've been involved in a watershed planning process and in a stream restoration and parks planning process and working with community groups and then also a local high school where, you know, many of the students have asthma because they live among the industry and so on and so forth. And so that's a project that we've been involved in for a couple of years, and we're continuing to do work with those community groups and those government agencies. And then the third project is we're collaborating with an organization called Latino Justice. Our project, our collaboration, is to work on an amicus brief in a lawsuit against FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security on behalf of Puerto Rican residents who are objecting to the way that the federal government has responded to hurricane by basically just rebuilding and replicating the traditional electric power grid system that doesn't work, that's highly vulnerable, that leaves the island vulnerable, and also continues to contribute to climate change rather than exploring and considering other alternatives such as renewable energy and so forth. It gives you some sense of the variety of ways in which resilience injustices play out.
Thanks, Tony, for describing the foundations of resilience justice in some of your current work. To some of your Resilience Justice fellows working on the NOAA project. They're applying a Resilience Justice framework, and you're saying that they are not a formula to be applied exactly. So explain that, would you?
Resilience Justice really is a toolbox approach. So there's not a one-size-fits-all. There's no model that we're trying to impose or proselytize in any wet kind of way. Instead, what we're looking for is how can we bring a set of tools to work alongside with and help the communities that are really seeking more just governance systems and seeking resilience and their ability to thrive in the future. It really is just very simply seven categories of factors that guide our analysis. And we do a lot of inductive analysis, building ideas and knowledge from the ground up by making observations, by doing interviews, by assessing the content of government plans and policies and laws and so forth. The framework really developed out of a synthesis of literally hundreds of studies that we read and drew upon related to issues of community resilience. What are the features of community resilience, the various conceptions of justice in human communities, and the intersection of those two. And our work draws on systems thinking. It draws on resilient science. It draws on some conceptualizations of justice that focus on things like human capabilities, community capacities, anti-oppression kinds of concepts of justice. And a focus on justice is empowering and transformative, not merely a distribution of resources or not merely participatory opportunities. So that's the more theoretical foundations of where we come from on this. In the studies that we looked at, our framework got developed and has been modified as we've applied it in a variety studies of working with community groups and or government agencies to analyze either resilience justice issues in a community or to analyze public policies and governance systems such as the water plant in California or that sort of thing. In the, for example, or the NOAA example where we're looking at how equitable climate adaptation planning is in coastal urban areas in the U.S. And so we look at seven factors, and the first, basically, to what extent do the public policies, plans, and laws and governance systems advance or impede the resilience, particularly of marginalized communities? And marginalized communities can be many different kinds of communities, but they are very often low-income communities of color. And the second sort of feature that we look at is inequality. They are unequally vulnerable. They're unequally vulnerable to climate change. They're unequally vulnerable to some sort of environmental disaster. They're unequally vulnerable to some disasters maybe caused by things that are not climate change, but made worse. But they're unequally vulnerable to things like gentrification, displacement, economic shock, the pandemic. If you live in a neighborhood where there are no parks nearby, and you're in this sort of health crisis, where do you go for nature and open space and that kind of thing? There's big disparities in communities, not only in Louisville, but really everywhere. So the second thing that we look at is inequality. Then third, we look at environmental conditions. So we're thinking about things like toxics and pollution in industry, but also disasters and climate change and green and blue infrastructure and those kinds of things. Then fourth, we're also looking at economic, social, and political conditions. And what are the features of those neighborhoods, some of which I mentioned, poverty rates and concentrations of people of color, the sort of racial segregation and ethnic segregation, language barriers, education levels, and so forth. Then we look at inclusive community engagement, the extent to which the government doesn't just have participatory opportunity for people to go down to City Hall and stand up at the microphone and express their opinion for their allotted 3 minutes, but actually ways in which the government reaches out and includes community members and community residents in decision-making and governance of the community. So that's that difference between inclusion and participation. And so we're looking there for power and empowerment, and are there co-governance structures that are created? Number six is feedback loops. Feedback loops are a big, important part of resilience thinking, because the idea is if we do all our planning and public policy and governance and law in a very linear way, and we develop an approach and then we just put it in motion, very often we find that we make terrible mistakes or things change in unexpected ways. One of the phrases everybody says with resilience is unprecedented is the new normal, right? Unprecedented is the new normal. How do governance systems adapt to changes, to disruptions, to disasters, to disturbances, and so on and so forth? From a resilience justice perspective, what we're asking is, to what extent are we paying attention to what's happening in our more marginalized and vulnerable communities? Are we monitoring that? Are we assessing that? Are we adapting what we're doing in order to help those communities be resilient and thrive? But then also, are we engaging them? Are the members of those communities part of the monitoring and the assessing and the learning and the revising that is an essential feature of feedback loops? And then finally, number seven, we talk about adverse impacts. And here what we're really looking at is, to what extent are the public policies, plans, laws, governance systems causing adverse impacts on the community? And so we're looking specifically for features that are more harmful to the community than helpful to the community. And for example, the combination of feedback loops and adverse impacts leads us to think about things like gentrification and displacement. Very often, the government may have very well-intentioned policy interventions in a neighborhood, but really what they do is primarily stimulate investment and out of control, skyrocketing housing prices, rents. You're maybe making housing less available to people and so forth as these become developed, and they become gentrified and they become whiter and wealthier, and the low income people of color who've been living there and experiencing these unequal conditions are displaced. And so that's an example of that kind of resilience injustice. That vulnerability means that we have a lack of both justice and resilience. And so that's part of our analytical approach. It's not a formula. It leads us to really rigorously and critically assess what the government is doing and how our governance systems could change, or how those particular communities might work with the government to develop co-governance systems that improve both resilience and justice for those communities.
I'd like to cross generations now, and we'll hear from two of your resilience justice fellows about how they got involved with the Resilience Justice Project and the work that they are contributing to some of the project you described. Let's speak first with Ira Ewers, who is working on the NOAA Equitable Adaptation Project. Ira is a third-year law student at the Brandeis School of Law at the University of Louisville. She has a BS in Environmental Studies from the New School and worked for over 5 years in corporate industrial waste diversion and sustainable product development. For the summer of 2024, she is joining the New York Lawyers for the Public Interest's Environmental Justice Team. Ira, tell us about how you got from Oklahoma to Ecuador, New York, Kentucky, and for the summer back to New York, developing an interest in resilience justice along the way.
I was an FFA in Oklahoma, rural Oklahoma. So that was, at that time, was Future Farmers of America. And that really cultivated an interest in ecology and the soil system, and obviously the livelihoods of rural Oklahomans who were my peers. So first American and farming community in Oklahoma. And so the environmental studies was a way to look at the sociological components, the economics of sustainability and climate change, and apply that to social and economic systems. So I had a kind of an institutional focus in my thesis on sustainable finance and all that jazz. So why University of Louisville Brandeis School of Law? I fell in love with Kentucky as a state, but what actually drew me was Dr. Arnold and the Resilience Justice Program. So I actually did apply specifically hoping to work under Dr. Arnold. And of course, I had that dream come true.
So you are now going into your third year of law school. You had community activism experience in addition to the environmental component. Tell me about the community activism.
First, I think it's twofold. One of the most influential experiences that creates my own conceptual framework of activism was actually living with an indigenous rural community in Ecuador prior to moving to New York City. So they actually worked in an agricultural cooperative. There, they had a microfinance arm of the business, and then they provided access to tools, resources, and a seed bank program for the local community. Being exposed to that.
What organization was that?
It's called Mushuk Yoyay. It's a Quechua-based organization in Ecuador. And I was 18. I did not speak Spanish. I'd come from Oklahoma. I had no concept of the world.
How did you ever find that?
I did a program with the New School where they allowed first year, instead of going straight to New York, some students went to Ecuador and Brazil.
A great experience.
Yeah, it was so beautiful. It was so humbling. It really changed my world. It changed who I am. It changed everything about me. And it gave me a lot of insight into vulnerability, but also resilience, right? The cultural resilience, social resilience of these indigenous communities that are just so magical, so incredibly magical. Instead of having a meeting about quinoa, for example, in a boardroom, we would go up into the mountains and sit with the quinoa and have fire with the quinoa clan and commune in a totally different way. It's not detached at all. It's right there. And so that inspires my level of activism, which is actually a lot of coming inward about having those close conversations, being very humble, especially as a white woman, right? And trying to continuously make an impact in these big systems.
So what courses have you taken that have given you skills or insights to be able to begin to address these issues?
Yeah, it starts in undergrad. I think the New School had an interdisciplinary approach, so I got to take a lot of design-based courses. And I think one of my favorite courses was Urban Systems, is what we called it. And it was taught by Timon McPherson. He does a lot of work in socio-ecological systems, where we started mapping flows of money, mapping flows of people, mapping flows of different natural resources in a different geographical sphere. So I picked New Orleans at that point. And some of that research still carries on today, especially with the NOAA-funded project that we're doing, which is assessing climate adaptation planning. So that course actually looked at a lot of New Orleans plans post-Katrina in response to such a socio-ecological disaster and assess them in terms of a systems analysis. And yeah, that is a lot of the work that we're doing on a larger scale today. So that's a fun course. I did a lot of statistics. I did, of course, ecology, urban ecology, though, mostly with the focus on urban systems, hydrological systems in urban spaces, because water, land rights, all of those different aspects of zoning and cities are so complex. And then at Brandeis, Dr. Arnold teaches water resources, and he taught an amazing course last fall. It was such a different interdisciplinary approach to environmental law. We looked at it through different narrative lenses. He has such a unique way of teaching and approaching this large system.
So when you come back after your summer internship, you're working on another study.
Yeah, this one's really fun. So currently, the Resilience Justice Project, along with Georgia State and Georgetown, received a NOAA-funded grant project to assess 8 urban cities' climate adaptation plan.
And the cities are cities that are vulnerable through rising seas and other climate change to inundation.
Yes. It's turned into a 2-year, multi-year project where researchers have looked at the planning processes used in these 8 urban areas from 3 different frameworks. The output of this research will actually be guides and workbooks and proposals for each of the 8 urban areas. We will have tailored feedback and policy proposals for each urban area, and then collective kind of best practices that we've seen across these 8 plans as well. We're not looking at the outcome of these plans because a lot of these plans are multi-year, but we are looking at the engagement, the acts of commission, and even acts of omission. What is not in the plans, or what could be in the plans that could be more explicit.
Iris, thank you very much for speaking with me. Best of luck.
Thank you, Julie. You too.
Iris' account of her formal education and her work and her study experience. In addition to that, you've heard from Tony Arnold, and we'll hear from our next guest, Carcel Barrett, gives us an idea of the large toolbox used in the work of the Resilience Justice Project. Now let's turn to the second Resilience Justice Fellow and the second project that Tony described. Carcel Barrett is a third-year law student at the Brandeis School of Law. She holds a Master of Public Administration degree with a focus on public and nonprofit management and policy from NYU's Graduate School for Public Service, as well as a Bachelor of Science in Professional Studies from NYU's School of Education. Carcel, you're working full-time?
Yes.
And going to law school, and you're a Resilience Justice Fellow.
Yes.
And you have time for volunteer activities and special classes.
Yes.
When did you decide to concentrate on Resilience Justice?
That happens during my first year of law school.
I met Dr. Arnold,
and in his presentation, I learned that I lived in a neighborhood that had a lot of environmental issues, and I knew some of the issues because I've experienced them, but I did not know how pervasive it was. And in talking with him, I didn't even know how to do anything about what was going on.
What issues were facing you at that time?
I've had typical seasonal allergies as a normal person, but when we purchased our home and moved to this particular neighborhood, I developed asthma. We have a lot of dust that accumulates in our house, a lot of black stuff. There are a lot of huge factories that are within about 5-mile radius that just pumps the stuff into the air. And I told my husband, I said, something's not right around here because I've had allergy issues, but I've never developed all these other chronic issues. And he brushed it off initially, but then he even noticed that we smell chemicals in the air occasionally. Pretty bad. And again, I didn't understand it because I didn't have the tools to put everything together until I met Dr. Arnold, and then it all made worse then.
So is this the Mill Creek area that he worked?
Yes.
Professor Arnold told me that you were passionate about resilience justice. Would you say that there's something other than your personal experience with the pollutants in the air that are causing problems that got you passionate about it?
Yeah, I think particularly moving here, and I don't know if it's because it's still a pretty decent sized city, but it's definitely smaller than New York, and I would say smaller than Metro Atlanta, not Atlanta proper. I've been able to see a lot of things take place, and my husband has a lot of family members in the neighborhood located here called the West End, and that's to the particularly predominantly black neighborhoods in Louisville. And I remember talking with his mom, and she said the train that transports supplies to businesses would just stop in the middle of our neighborhood. and not move. And you couldn't travel where you had to go. You had to go around, and it caused issues. And things like that. About a train station there, it's blowing pollutants in the air. It's blocking people from being able to get to their destination. It's beyond a major inconvenience, even to try to get to work. There's nothing that's terribly far in Louisville, but my husband leaves out over an hour earlier for work just in case a train is stopped and he's unable to get to his job. Because if he gets to his job, he's fine, and then that's issues for us at home. But just thinking about things like that, where there's no thought given to the people in the neighborhood and what is being done to them, you wouldn't find that in, let's say, what we call the East End of town, which would be St. Matthews. You would see a train just stop in the middle of St. Matthews, and that's a predominantly white neighborhood. And things like that, just think, now that I have the knowledge through Professor Arnold to know that there's things that can be done, those things are what makes me passionate about this type of work. Because I know the people in the community feel like they don't have a voice, and it's just because they don't know what to do. And if I have the opportunity to at least educate and help them through that process, I feel like I've done my good deed for the day, for the week, for my life. But I feel like I'm helping someone who could then turn around and help someone else.
Thank you, Carcel, for letting us understand your passion for the work. In addition to working as a paralegal and going to law school, Carcel is working toward her PhD in education. We'll hear more from her in our next episode when we discuss how resilience is enhanced through education. Now we'll turn back to Tony Arnold to learn how his work has spread worldwide.
Eventually, one of the things we're hoping to do more is working with communities in the Global South, but we don't have a specific project there yet.
You mentioned the Global South, a term under debate, but broadly defined as countries classified by the World Bank as low or middle income that are located in Africa, Asia, Oceania, Latin America, and the Caribbean. In addition to the projects in the U.S., we need to note that Pakistan has adopted some of your work. Is Pakistan part of the Global South?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court of Pakistan issued a landmark climate justice opinion a couple, 3 years ago, and part of their opinion cites my work on environmental justice. That was exciting to see. And there's a project in Senegal involving agroecology and what they call peasant movement, low-income residents and so forth, and that they are using the resilience justice framework for their community-based work at building a more resilient agricultural system among their lowest income community members and so forth. So that's maybe another example of where that sort of played out. A lot of our thinking, a lot of our research comes out of examples from the Global South and ways in which Global South communities push back against either capitalism as our savior or Marxism as our savior. And that's often out there in thinking and literature and whatnot. For example, if you live in sort of slum communities in a city in Africa, you're thinking about your inequalities and your vulnerabilities, but you're also thinking about what can empower your community and how can we think in different ways that aren't just imposed upon us from the global north, from that sort of thing. And there's been a lot of discussion about some ways that we talk about resilience are really about just making sure that global north economic and political systems are resilient. So that is a criticism that's out there, but that doesn't mean that we should give up on resilience for communities. It means that we need to think about how resilience could be redefined in a more equity-oriented way, in a more bottom-up, grassroots way. And so we see those examples in the Global South where people are arguing for that or making those points or identifying those problems. And so in some ways, we've been influenced by the Global South in what we do with the Resilience Justice Project. But then, not surprisingly, ideas and our framework has been
interesting and useful to both scholars and activists, and to some degree government officials as well in Global South communities. And we see number of examples in Africa. There's some efforts at agroecology in Senegal, for example, some management of forest and fisheries and so forth in various countries in Africa. Brazil has, there are several communities in Brazil that kind of latched on to our ideas. We've done some work in Portugal, which then led to opportunities to connect to people in Brazil because of the common language of the Portuguese language. And there's a lot of cross-Atlantic collaboration going on there. And because this could be broadcast over the internet, then now all of a sudden, people in Brazil are learning about these ideas and they can track down the publications. And we're no longer 7 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon. Everything just a click on Google away, right?
That just shows the global dissemination of knowledge and ideas. And it's two-way. And speaking with Irie and also other students who had experience with indigenous communities and their approach to decision-making may inform the resilience justice work. And yeah, that comes back the other way. So it's right, a complete circle.
It is. And and there's so many different ways that those connections can happen. And so I'm part of an environmental justice consortium or network internationally, and there are a number of people in, again, both Africa and Latin America who are really interested in our work and drawing upon those ideas. The example from Pakistan you mentioned was more of a, it was a shocker, and it is really more the environmental justice work I had done that kind of led up to the creation of Resilience Justice Project. But it was the Supreme Court of Pakistan came out with a landmark climate justice judicial opinion that caught everybody's attention internationally, and they cited my environmental justice work in their opinion, which was exciting and totally surprising. And again, this interconnectedness of the world. Now, we'll have to see what impact that has in the long run. But I think while the Resilience Justice Project believes that kind of law is not our magic answer to everything, certainly when you have major climate justice opinions coming out of courts, that helps to support the grassroots movement towards resilience justice. So that's exciting to see.
That's quite an enlightening example of the cross-fertilization and the spread of ideas globally in our modern world. Now we're going to look at another aspect of your work, fostering community involvement. Public policy and conflict resolution have been in your toolkit since you were at Stanford.
When I went to Stanford Law School, I was a founding co-editor of the Stanford Law and Policy Review, looking at intersections between law and public policy. I was a graduate student fellow at the Stanford Center for Conflict and Negotiation, where I got to work with Nobel Prize winning scholars in economics and psychology and political science, as well as law.
Resilience Justice Fellow Carcel Barrett has told us about the broad range of her education and practical experience as well, to which she added conflict resolution training she received in a workshop that she was selected for that was run for law students by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
They gathered students from various law schools in the country to learn how to communicate with each other across differences. We had to learn how to communicate with each other, not even necessarily come to an agreement because you may never change your stance, but to at least understand each other's point of view and how we could continue to work with each other moving forward. This workshop is helping to foster things like that so that we can have a more congenial community overall, even though there are instances where we are adversarial. So I've benefited a lot from that workshop, and I always promote it to everyone.
Negotiation and conflict resolution skills are helpful when working with communities to enhance community resilience, which leads to one of the solutions that your papers suggest, co-governance. How can you have effective co-governance when the general population doesn't have those skills?
So there are tremendous challenges and obstacles to achieving co-governance that is equitable and empowering. But there are examples where it's working well, and we also have to ask, in comparison to what? So if it's all top-down governance, any move toward co-governance is actually a step in the right direction, even if maybe we haven't gone the entire distance that we want to go. Yeah, we're at least moving in the right direction. So there are examples. We're working on a paper right now that's trying to identify some of the design principles that go into co-governance that will lead to resilience justice. One thing that's key is true shared power. So the government has to be willing to share power. And I think that the community has to have some degree of trust, but also not be afraid to question, to challenge the government, to protest, to say, okay, you said that you're going to do this, but this is actually just superficial, and you're not really sharing power, or our community concerns aren't being heard. I think we have to recognize that any time that different voices across a community and even in just one neighborhood, different residents have different views. And so I don't think we're always going to have a uniform view that all people of Pueblo nations in the American Southwest feel the same way about this project or that example, or low-income neighborhoods of color in Los Angeles. There are some commonalities, but then there are also some differences. And I think we have to be okay with it. We have to recognize that messiness of governance is just part of governance. That's the reality of it. But that is different than top down. It's also different than purely community-based governance where there's no government involvement. That's oftentimes referred to as a commons. That was a concept developed by Eleanor Ostrom, who wrote a lot about that. And it can be very grassroots, it can be very empowering and exciting for communities, but it is also, from a resilience justice perspective, somewhat concerning that it is primarily a pull yourself up by your bootstraps approach. It's the idea that the government is just going to leave the local parks or the trees or whatnot to neighborhoods that have been marginalized, have been oppressed, have histories of centuries of subjugation and discrimination, fewer resources, and they just gonna have to create their own infrastructure on their own or manage their own environments on their own. And from our perspective, that fails to provide societal and governmental resources, our legal authority that is often needed. And so that's why we focus on co-governance. And what we're trying to suggest is that co-governance is really a new form, and it may have started out as a hybrid of the top down and the bottom up, but it's really its own system now. It's evolved in that way. And there are, I think, promising examples. Well, I guess I would say that there's also no single model that's the answer either, that because every community has its own needs, its own circumstances, its own history and culture. Is therefore, to try to impose a model of co-governance is not ideal. What we really want to do is to identify what are the key questions or what are the key institutional choices that have to be made, and how can we support that?
Tony, thank you. You've given our listeners a lot to think about. Thank you so much for speaking with me once again.
Oh, thank you, Julie. Yeah, it's really great to talk with you. Great to see you again after these years, and just such a joy to share what we're doing with Resilience Justice Project with you and with your listeners.
Tune in next time when we discuss resilience through education with Professor Juan Sepulveda of Trinity University and two of his students. You can hear this and previous episodes of Living Into the Future on WTBRFM.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and other streaming services. You can even ask your smartphone or other device to play Living Well Into the Future podcast. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode, and give us a 5-star rating so others can find us. For more information about our guests, show notes, and information about past episodes, go to our website, livingwellintothefuture.net. Our thanks from me, Julie B. Adler, to Berkshire Alley, WTBR-FM 89.7 Pittsfield, and the Berkshire Eagle for their support. This podcast is produced by Julie Kopenheffer. Our music is written and performed by Michael Kopenheffer. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guest and not of WTBR-FM, Berkshire Alley, and Berkshire Eagle, or the LWITF production team.